AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hi there, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and this is Women Who Travel. This episode we ask, what happens when plants leave their original homes and put down roots elsewhere? Is it any different from humans who move? When are they considered out of place? When are they allowed to belong? And are they accepted or rejected by the people who live there? Can we look at plants to better understand our own relationship with the world?
I sort of started with plants that were intimately connected to me, and I kind of just said, okay, what are you telling me? Are you telling me something about poetry? Are you telling me something about the history of plant breeding? I just sort of asked questions of each plant to begin with. I gave myself that permission to play.
My guest is Jessica J. Lee, who's Canadian and of Chinese and Welsh ancestry. She currently lives in Berlin, and she's an environmental historian who also teaches creative writing at the University of Cambridge and is a children's book author. Right now, Jessica's talking to me from her Taiwanese mother's home in Ontario. Jessica talks of how her mum constructed a koi pond in their home in suburban Canada. But Ontario winters are harsh, and so when it got cold, the fish were moved to a tank in the dining room. It was a relentless attempt to recreate a Taiwanese landscape far from home. Your mother has a koi pond in Canada where you are right now, I think. You're at that house.
I'm at my mother's, yes.
Does she have a koi pond now, or was that left behind?
She doesn't have a koi pond now because she's in an apartment, but she does have a fish and a garden still. But in most of the places she lived where she could still have a koi pond, she had one. And it was this way of connecting herself to home and a kind of past aesthetic of, you know, growing up in Taiwan and the ideal garden that she wanted to see in her life.
I really love the way that you're able to use this writing about plants to talk about all these other parts of your life and the way it's all interconnected.
When I was trying to title this book, I kept coming back to the idea of dispersals because I liked the idea of it not being an obvious plant word. I didn't want it to be called like uprooted or something, even though it was, you know, a book about movement and about movements of plants.
Dispersals on Plants, Borders, and Belonging, which is out this month, blends the cultural influences and writing styles that shape her.
I was thinking a lot about seed dispersals, but I think ultimately, if I had to come up with a more explanatory, a more expository title for the book, it might be something like Plants and People Out of Place.
Well, I love dispersals because it's really visual to me. I never really think of plants moving, and they're always moving.
It began from this question of, okay, how do we make sense of plants out of place? You know, plants we've moved, plants we've bred and taken out of their original contexts, you know, seeds we've saved in seed banks, plants we've brought with us in migration.
I haven't read like a huge amount of nature writing, but it felt very different from nature writing I have read because it was so much memoir as well as observation. I guess it's sort of on a very basic level, we can't survive without plants.
Absolutely.
I think plants can survive without us, but we can't survive without them. So it's sort of impossible to not talk about the personal and the self in some way.
You know, there are two parallel strands in nature writing. We see nature writing as this, like, very masculine kind of objective trope of setting out into the landscape and telling its history without really unpacking our own positionality. And then we often see a lot of things that are more straightforwardly memoir. And as someone who's trained in history and works as a nature writer, it was important to me to find that middle road and to actually say, okay, I want to talk about the histories of these plants and these places and these natural things. But I think pretending like they don't have some personal import to me, that they don't have some entwinement with my own life, didn't make sense. You know, so many of the plants that I've chosen at least to write about are cultural products. You know, they've been hugely shaped by our desires, our inputs, the changes we've made just by bringing them around the world and using them in different ways, breeding them in different ways.
Jessica's book has 14 stories that take readers all over the world through its plants. Heather in the UK, tea in the Himalayas, or the many different kinds of seaweed in the oceans, and cherry blossom in Berlin and the widespread cultivation of soy. It's a way to talk about migration and how we ourselves move around the world.
Human migrations and plant migrations, they're really entwined things, right? Most plants have moved because humans have moved. I'm the third generation of migrants in my family, and I've moved continents multiple times. I've moved all over, seemingly never staying still. And so for me, it seemed like a way of maybe unpacking my own understanding of what those migrations mean, to sort of look at them through plants and to ask questions through plants. And also, I don't know, to offer those plants a little bit more attention in their own migration stories.
Jessica swam 52 lakes in Germany in 52 weeks. Along the way, she became curious about the many types of seaweed she encountered.
The more I have thought about seaweed in my life, the more I'm just in awe of its beauty and its power. You know, I write in this essay about seaweeds of being terrified as a child when they would, you know, touch my legs or whatever it was as I was swimming. It was deeply uncomfortable. But I also had this, like, parallel obsession with the ocean and with the colors of being underwater. I wanted to be a marine biologist, as all millennial girls, but I was also deathly afraid of swimming and seaweed. Make it make sense. But no, I mean, the more I sort of sat down and said, okay, I want to know this plant, I want to understand its impact and its power and so much more about it, the more that I realized, okay, we can learn so much here, whether it's, you know, the history of women in science, because seaweeds were one of the few areas that women were allowed to really excel in the sciences early on.
Is that because no one else was interested in the seaweed?
Well, that, and it was, seaweeds were considered polite because they didn't have these, like, showy, sexualized flowers. They reproduced by spores, and therefore for Victorian women, that was quite acceptable, right? It wasn't racy, it wasn't sexy. And so seaweeds and mosses and things were the, you know, the domain of women scientists early on. So, you know, we can learn a lot from that, but then also, you know, seaweeds holding this record of the past ocean and really being threatened by changes to our climate. I feel like they represent a lot, right? Now we're in this moment where we're like, oh, algae and biofuels and seaweed farming, it's the thing of the future.
There are many different types of seaweed, right?
Very, very, very many.
How many, roughly, ballpark?
Thousands.
Thousands, okay.
Yeah, yeah. In the book, I focus specifically on two, but the main one I focus on is wakame kelp, which is considered invasive in a lot of the world, but originates sort of on the coasts of Asia, but is also delicious. I sort of unpack those multiple trajectories of the seaweeds. I write a little bit about my family's different encounters with seaweed as food, my mom in her Taiwanese cooking, and my father being Welsh in lava bread, which is made of the same algae that we use for nori in seaweed, actually. And just getting to know a little bit about the history that sort of unites food cultures and also aquaculture cultures across borders and oceans.
Next up, Jessica talks a lot about how plants are interconnected with many parts of her life, like in her chapter about tea.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
You grew up with 2 very different kinds of tea drinking rituals. Your Welsh dad's tea, and I must add that my mum's Welsh, and your mother, who's Taiwanese, her jasmine tea. And you said that you selected these plants based on kind of like personal connections. What did those rituals kind of say about the 2 sides of you?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because when I started working on the TSA, I was slightly terrified that I was focusing too much on the cultural side and not enough on the plant itself. But I realized that was kind of an inevitability because the second I dove into the history of that plant, I basically saw my 2 cultures that are, you know, in my body, in my family. I saw them immediately laid out in front of me, and I saw their conflicts, and I saw the tensions that are, you know, in some ways unresolved between Britain and China in particular. And that for me was really, it was one of those essays and it's one of those plants that forces me to think about, I think, 2 things being true at once, right? What it means to belong to 2 cultures, what it means to belong to 2 cultures that have been in conflict, and how you sort of navigate that when it's like, okay, well, what is my position then as this hybrid person? And, you know, I realized that with tea, I move between the different kinds of tea drinking cultures. I'm staying at my mom's right now, and I went to make myself a cup of like proper tea, like British tea, the other day, and she didn't have the proper stuff. And I was like, I don't want anything. And she was like, oh, no, I can get you something. I was like, no, if it's not going to be the correct way, I don't want it. And then I think, okay, it's a kind of rigidity, right? Where I'm like, yeah. I want my British tea right now a certain way, and I want my Chinese or Taiwanese tea a certain way.
Oh, I can't order tea in America. Everyone gets it wrong.
Oh, God, I would never order tea in America. I hate to say it.
No, it's true. Sorry to all listeners who may be offended by that, but really, it's like pond water here. I don't know what people do to it.
I think they microwave the water.
conspiracy theory.
Yeah, no, it's really, it's one of those things where I think tea for me was really revealing in that it taught me about my cultural commitments and also taught me about the areas where those cultural commitments are in conflict and how to actually hold both of those things at once. So in a way, thinking about tea for me was this lesson in processing my mixed race identity.
Well, and tea is, of all the plants you talk about, I would say sort of historically probably one of the most complicated. You know, it's so wrapped up in colonialism, and Britain is quite famous for that. And the impacts that that has both on the country that's the power and the country that is home to the plantations, which is often not holding that power. It feels like such a interesting tension to explore, like greater global issues, I guess, as well as your own identities.
Yeah, I think that was exactly it, right? Like being able to say, okay, the story I'm telling is the story of 2 particular regions in relation to tea. It's not the whole story. And I acknowledge that in the essay, but that it teaches me something about uneven power. You know, I trace the story of this botanist, Robert Fortune, who famously stole tea from China, stole tea production methods. And I write about this incident that, you know, he documents in his own travelogues of dressing up in Mandarin dress, as he puts it, you know, arranging his hair so that he would look Chinese and could pass and therefore enter a region that he was not supposed to enter as a Scotsman in order to steal tea.
What era was this? What century?
This was in the early 19th century. And so, yeah, just really, I think like setting tea and its history within that context and saying, okay, this is its history. And I know as a historian, I should read this, quote unquote, objectively. But as a person belonging to both of those cultures, reading that history makes me deeply uncomfortable.
We talk about non-native plants or invasive species in ways that are so often negative. Jessica confronts this head on. Shouldn't a plant be allowed to take root, be protected regardless of where it came from? Isn't it natural for plants to disperse? And when are plants displaced? And then there's a story about Japanese cherry blossom, which is also about the politics of a plant that adds such beauty to our landscapes and our cities.
I didn't know a huge amount about cherry blossoms before I started working on them. I live in Berlin, where there are cherry blossom trees planted in the sort of path of where the Berlin Wall once stood, and they were gifted from Japan. You know, many cities have these cherry trees that are, you know, acts of diplomacy. And they were always the biggest joy. You know, they're coming in now, actually, and it's the best part of spring. But then when you dive into that history, of course, the symbolism of that tree is, it's incredibly complex, right? And you see at the, you know, at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century in Japanese imperialism, you know, the cherry blossom comes to represent something completely different, right? It has these nationalist ideas. You see cherry blossoms on the side of kamikaze planes. You see soldiers being sent off with cherry blossoms pinned to their breasts, right? And there is this idea of the symbolism and pressure that we put on the natural world for human ideals is something I really wanted to unpack, because I think we look at cherry blossoms and we think beauty and delicacy and joy, and those are really weighty things to additionally put on it. You know, one of the stories I trace is about the planting of cherry trees across Korea and Taiwan, where my mother's from, under Japanese occupation, and how the planting of specific trees was intended to, you know, to say this territory is culturally a part of this empire, and that the natural world is not neutral in the way it's deployed, right? That we use it to our ends, and the legacies of those trees and what they symbolize now in the wake of that.
Sort of the very act of planting a tree can be settling on a land, stealing a land.
Absolutely, right? The choices we make in which trees to plant are political explicitly.
It's funny that we're having this conversation right now, because it really is when the cherry blossoms are coming out. And I was having a conversation with someone a few days ago who was showing me pictures of cherry blossoms that she had taken in January. And we were talking about how that's just, it's the wrong time. And cherry blossoms blooming too early feels like a really just sort of egregious example of the climate being unwell. Is that something you also noticed in a lot of your research, that these migration patterns and, you know, seasonal changes are off?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, you know, I write about that sort of towards the end of the cherry blossom chapter, you know, walking around my neighborhood where there are, you know, autumn and winter flowering cherries, but that also the spring ones are coming earlier and earlier. Actually, just, you know, 2 weeks ago, I was walking around my neighborhood and I stopped because I noticed the cherry blossoms were coming in and I thought, are these the winter ones? And I went up and looked and they were brand new spring buds and they were like the full frilly spring flowers. And I thought, this is very early. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think this is where it's, you know, understanding plants and their stories means understanding their pasts and their legacies, but also their futures and how we are deploying them to think about our futures now, whether that's like, you know, understanding climate change through cherry blossom festivals and you know, when the cherries come in. It's a great way of marking the sort of changing benchmark of our climate. So these plants are, you know, they're bound up in our pasts, but they're also really, really bound up in our futures.
Next up, a detour into Jessica's kitchen, where she's been researching how to make soy sauce. Turns out, there's bottles upon bottles of it fermenting in her pantry.
Do you sometimes wake up with the desire to understand the seen and the unseen forces guiding you through this life? And are you ready to begin uncovering the impacts of these forces in your day-to-day? Do you feel that you could use a little push, a little oomph, or maybe even a little juju to be reminded of your power within your ancestors to truly understand you? Well, child, so it sounds like you need a little juju podcast in your life. Hey, Bays, I'm your host, Juju Bay. Welcome, Aquaba, bienvenidos to the Womanist Witchy Insight Show, diving deep into the Black healing journey, pop culture juju, and the ancestral spiritual systems that can help get us free. So please come on over and join the ALJ Pod family. New episodes drop every single Wednesday, and you can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You write of making soy sauce as a means to kind of get to know yourself or connect with yourself deeper, and of your mother's mango tree. How do these plants kind of connect us as humans on a, I guess, on an emotional level and, you know, as acts of love?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's partly about memory and resonance and sensation. I can read a little bit from the soy sauce chapter, if you like.
I would love to hear that.
Okay. I've got a little bit here in which I'm making soy sauce. From the apartments I've lived in over recent years, Berlin, London, Cambridge, I watch videos of Li Ziqi, the Chinese blogger who farms her grandmother's land in rural Sichuan. I watch her dressed in traditional clothing, carrying baskets into the green, harvesting soybeans in the field, freeing them from their fuzzy green pods, grinding them into a cream-colored pulp. Thinking about soy, for me, has become a kind of dreaming. In the past 16 years, I have moved house more times than I can count, moved countries and continents. Now, in my mid-30s, I simply want time and space. As much as I have wanted a child or a family, I've wanted to learn to make soy sauce. I do not know if the skill is in my bones, if my palate is sharp enough to measure the nuances of fermentation, if I will ever be in one place long enough to begin the process and see it through, but I decide to make it anyway. I tell my husband of my secret dreams: to open a soy milk shop, a breakfast stall, to open a tofu factory, a soy sauce shop. I won't, I don't expect, but others have done, will do. I find boutique tofu shops opening in the cities I love, making tempeh and natto from local pulses, artisanal soy sauce vendors and soy concept stores on the streets of cool neighborhoods I can no longer afford. While I write, I soak beans. They swell and burst in their hours of submersion. I boil them, pulse them, strain them for milk. I've learned to make something that replicates that childhood comfort. I sip it warm, fresh from the stove. A year from now, I will strain sauce from the soy. I'll stack a cast iron pan, a pestle and mortar, a heavy board atop the fermented mash. I'll leave it overnight and through the morning. The muslin lining the colander will stain a copper brown that shines beneath my kitchen's fluorescent bulb. Everything will have the smell and feel of salt. It'll take a day at least to press the liquid through. A year and 5 days from when I unpacked dried beans. For so long, I've dreamt of a home where I can fill jars with soybeans, just to stir them every day, week, month, until one day I could lift the lid and witness something, a scent, a flavor, that my grandmother might have known well. The jars of beans my grandmother described to me are long in the distance and the past, but I have sought those sensations still. The grit of salt on bean, the softening of a pulse to pulp, a color that is far deeper than I can describe.
That was so peaceful to listen to, which sounds like the process of making soy itself, that you have to wait a year.
Yeah, it's... I am not a patient person.
I was about to say, are you patient? Because I would be, I don't know if I,
no.
I don't think my skill set is going to be in making soy.
I think that was also part of what enticed me to make soy sauce as part of Yeah. You know, my grandparents, my grandmother, her family had once been soy sauce manufacturers back in China. And I don't know, I think once I learned that, just the idea stuck in my head that I wanted to reclaim some of that knowledge somehow. I didn't want it to be lost knowledge. But I'm not patient. And so I would check on these jars of fermenting soybeans like all the time. I constantly was just, you know, peering into the cupboard being like, how are you doing? Are you done yet? Are you ready yet? And of course they're not, you know, they take a really long time. But it taught me something about waiting. And I think gradual change, because I documented it on Instagram and I you know, I put a lot of videos just to keep a kind of diary of it. And it's great to look back on because I can see the change when I watch it back, like photo by photo or video by video. But in the moment, it felt like an absolute eternity just waiting for these beans to do their thing. And so much is out of your control, right? It really is. Fermentation is kind of about letting go. You can set things up correctly. You can, you know, make sure things are clean, make sure things are well prepared to ferment, but then they do their own thing.
Which is so at odds, I think, with being a sort of modern day human being. We think we have control over everything and that everything should happen right away. And I mean, what a reminder that we really just, we can't control it. And we're totally out of control.
Absolutely. But it was, I mean, if you think about that and relinquishing that control and being open to, I think, the joy of it, like every month I would have to stir these fermenting soybeans, which meant that I got to check on them once a month. So I would open these jars to stir them. And it was, I don't know, it was kind of like Christmas morning once a month, right? Being like, okay, how are you?
I have to ask, was this during COVID?
Yes, of course it was.
I was like, yeah, I remember some of my projects and being really excited about them at the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea, I had been wanting to do it for like months before COVID, but it was actually only during COVID that we moved somewhere big enough that I could store huge amounts of soybeans fermenting for, yeah, as long as it would take me to actually make soy sauce.
Suddenly we had so much time on our hands.
Yeah, yeah. Because my husband took up wood carving and bird watching, and I took up soy sauce making. So
I love it. What a wholesome household you became. We've talked somewhat about you moving around the world, and you know, being connected to different places in the world. What does it feel like to plant seeds and then leave them behind?
I think it's one of the real sadnesses and griefs that I've held in a lot of ways, because I've moved so much that I feel like, I also feel a little bit like, okay, economically, is this sensible that I keep setting up whole gardens and then moving? But then I also think there's this huge act of hope and care and optimism in doing so, right? In wanting to be present for growth as it happens in the moment, and also being willing to, I think, leave that growth behind when, you know, not being able to sort of reap what I sow in a way. Towards the end of the book, I write about having planted a garden and not being able to see it through because I'm forced to move, and having to give all of those plants to a close friend of mine, and how in some ways there's this kind of like beautiful circularity in that she had gifted me loads of seeds as well. And it, I don't know, I think it just teaches me something about letting go and optimism and hope for the future.
The opposite of letting go. Do you think surrounding yourself with plants, even if it's temporary, is a means of keeping yourself rooted?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, there's something about putting your hands in soil. It's automatically rooting, right? It puts you in place. It means paying attention to the seasons and the weather and your belonging in the place where you are.
Lovely. This was so great. Where can listeners find you on the internet and follow along with your travels and your plants and your soy sauce making?
Well, I'm on Instagram and Twitter or X or whatever it's called at Jessica J. Lee, and on YouTube and TikTok under Jessica J. Lee Writes. But you can also find the book, all of my books, in your local bookseller.
I really like a wonderful, one of my favorite chats I've had in a long time. So thank you.
Thank you, Lale.
Being so generous with your thoughts.
Thank you.
Where in Wales is your dad from?
Cardiff.
Okay. My mum is from Brecon. So not too far.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, really not far. My uncle lives there.
Oh my God, it's like the most beautiful place ever.
It's lovely, yeah.
Next week, People travel for all sorts of obsessions and fascinations. But my very own sister-in-law crisscrosses America in search of every Major League Baseball stadium. But she shows me that it's so much more than just the sport itself. It's the food, it's the energy, it's road trips, and it's the fans themselves. Consider this episode your dose of America in the summer. See you then. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hanna. Our engineers are Jake Loomis, Nick Pittman, and James Yost. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. See you next week. I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.